The Accidental Entrepreneur is brought to you through our affiliate relationships with the following sponsors: Digital Accelerant, the digital mobile business card that generates leads. Text the word LAW to 21,000 to get connected and learn how to get your own digital business card. And by Fetch Internet and Fetch Pro, the secure, high-speed app that eliminates the need to pay for hotspots or use public unsecure Wi-Fi. And Printify, the online, on-demand print shop for all your corporate merchandise. Be sure to visit our online store and get your own podcast merch. Listen to all of our sponsors' commercials later in this episode and follow their links in the show notes to learn more about their products and services.
So, you know, when it was time for college, it was like, okay, time for college. Okay, counselor, how do I do it? And they're like, well, like, you know, if you want to go to UCLA and, you know, USC, these are the applications. Like, you fill them out, you send them in the mail. Good luck.
Yeah, this was just a guidance counselor at your school, right? This wasn't correct. Like a guy who had a, yeah, right.
So No. And the thing is, like, people, you know, the work I do now, there was no way my family could access. First of all, we didn't know that this, you know, this kind of support existed, let alone having the money to pay for it. And so I was self-taught through the process. So I was always like, it was almost like what's behind the magic curtain, right? Like, I feel like there's another world out there, the East Coast, these fancy schools. And so I basically learned everything that I could on my own through books, and, you know, the internet didn't have anywhere near what it has today. And I was able get into Cornell. And, you know, my high school's been around 50, 60 years. I'm the only person from its history to attend an Ivy League school, for context. So I, you know,
You think that they didn't really think that that was even an option, or
it's not an option,
because it's not just the school, you know, the guidance counselor system, even in the public schools, that's what you do. You go, they give you a brochure and they put you on. Now they have Naviance and all these systems, but it doesn't. Yeah. You're on your own, basically.
Yeah. So there's the lack of knowledge piece. There's also the culture piece, right? Like, you know, your parents say, what, why would you leave? We're here.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. And so you're expected to, you know, go to school there.
The information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work, and they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode. Just to remind you, the podcast is produced and brought to you by my legal practice, Beinhacker Law. We provide business and estate services to entrepreneurs, inventors, and other small business owners. Whether you're just getting started or you've been operating for a long time, contact us for all your general legal needs, from contracts to client agreements, from purchasing a new location to onboarding a new partner or key employee. We draft all types of agreements and handle most business transactions. For more information about our products and services, visit BeinhackerLaw.com, or you can follow our link in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's interview.
Hi, I'm Dr. Shamasyan. I help people get into medical school and top colleges. Been doing it for nearly 20 years, and it's a pleasure to help people achieve their educational and career goals.
All right, Chirag, so thanks for joining me on this, what I told you is a delirious Friday. I like got up this morning. We still have the car to unpack when we got back from Maryland, because it was like 2:30 in the morning. My poor other daughter's sleeping in the house with the dogs. So we just left everything in the car, and I didn't want to leave my wife with it. So I got up in the morning, unloaded the car, was soaking wet because it's hot out here, and you know, showered, ran to the office, and I had a 10 o'clock meeting. So it's been one of those days. I have a few more after you. But I did point out to you that we both went to Cornell. I went like much earlier than you did. But, you know, people say I look a little younger, so maybe I could lie, say I graduated like, you know, 2000 instead of 1989.
You could have fooled me. Go Big Red. And for all, you know, everyone out there wondering, you know, what happens after you graduate from Cornell decades after? Well, You buy headphones and a microphone and you talk to each other. That's the future for you.
Yeah, exactly. So I appreciate that. But you know that I'm passionate about college and the process. And I think that it's a ridiculous, I mean, we're just all, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid. You got to send your kid to school. You impoverish yourself or you take on a lot of debt. And not only that, because that's not really what we're talking about today. You know, there is a system to give you an advantage or not an advantage. If you just kind of throw caution to the wind, you know, it's not so good. But maybe we can go back because this is a business podcast, right? We want to talk about the business that you've built.
Sure.
And what you're doing. So maybe you can tell us about your background before Cornell and how you got into what you're doing. I think you got a PhD too, right? Out in California.
I do. Okay. Yeah.
So why don't you give us that whole story and
we'll
get caught up.
Happy to talk about it. And it's all interrelated to the work that I do specifically. So, you know, to go way, way back and to talk about the impetus for this whole thing. So I was born and raised in Los Angeles. I'm ethnically Armenian, but my parents are both immigrants from Lebanon. So they met there, got married there, moved here during the war. Why does this matter? Because they settled in the States. And, you know, when they had my brother and me, they were always talking about education.
Yeah.
Education. In fact, it was my parents' ticket out of Lebanon, essentially. My dad came here to get his master's, you know, settled in St. Louis for 2 years, and then they moved to LA. And so it was always like, go to great schools, you know, get a job with benefits. Essentially, to them, the education and the opportunity meant stability, the stability they didn't have.
And that's true with all ethnic families. I mean, I grew up in a Jewish family from Eastern Europe. It's the same thing. I have friends from India. You're a loser if you don't become a doctor, a lawyer, or some other professional. You know?
That's right. Yeah. Be a doctor, dentist, lawyer, engineer, all that good stuff. And exactly. You know, very similar. But except the issue with it is, you know, when you haven't had your schooling, you know, in the States and you're not affluent and all that kind of stuff, it's always like, hey, yeah, son, do this. Okay, dad, how do I do it? What? Like, you know, figure it out. We figured it out. You'll be fine. You know, it was that kind of thing.
Exactly. Just can't be that hard.
Yeah. So I went to a, you know, small Armenian school in Los Angeles. So my parents wanted us to grow up in an Armenian enclave. And, you know, I didn't have non-Armenian friends basically until college, other than, you know, kids in the neighborhood. And so I, you know, I went to this kind of school, but now all my teachers were essentially immigrants. My college counselor was an immigrant to this country. So it's not like I had any sort of roadmap or plan that was handed to me. So,
and do you speak Arabic? Is that what
I speak Armenian?
Armenian is a separate language.
Yes. So in Lebanon, they speak, you know, Arabic and French and English, but we're Armenian. So my parents speak Armenian, Arabic, English, and French. I speak Armenian and English.
So you learned.
That's our mother tongue. And so, you know, they wanted us to grow up around that, to have that community, to have that language and culture.
You know, continue your roots. Everybody wants to do that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I have a 3-year-old now and I speak with him and all that stuff. But so, you know, when it was time for college, it was like, okay, time for college. Okay, counselor, how do I do it? And they're like, well, like, you know, if you want to go to UCLA and, you know, USC, these are the applications. Like, you fill them out, you send them in the mail. Good luck.
Now, this was just a guidance counselor at your school, right? This wasn't like a guy who had a,
So No. And the thing is, like, people, you know, the work I do now, there was no way my family could access. First of all, we didn't know that this, you know, this kind of support existed, let alone having the money to pay for it. And so I was self-taught through the process. So I was always like, it was almost like what's behind the magic curtain, right? Like, I feel like there's another world out there, the East Coast, these fancy schools. And so I basically learned everything that I could on my own through books and, you know, the internet didn't have anywhere near what it has today. And I was able get into Cornell. And you know, my high school's been around 50, 60 years. I'm the only person from its history to attend an Ivy League school, for context. So I, you know,
You think that they didn't really think that that was even an option, or
it's not an option, you know,
because it's not just the school, you know, the guidance counselor system, even in the public schools, that's what you do. You go, they give you a brochure and they put you on. Now they have Naviance and all these systems, but it doesn't. Yeah. You're on your own basically.
Yeah. So there's the lack of knowledge piece. There's also the culture piece, right? Like, you know, your parents say, what, why would you leave? We're here.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. And so you're expected to, you know, go to school there, you know,
especially the get California married to someone from your community. Right?
It's great. Right. Right. It's terrific.
And it's a lot of people out of state want to go. They can't get in, you know, that type of stuff. But yeah, but we both know Cornell's better. So
yeah, there you go.
That worked out.
And so, you know, went there and was also able to secure a bunch of financial aid and scholarships. And so I was able to, you know, get out with no debt from tuition or anything like that. And it was interesting because along the way you know, I started meeting people who were almost like a secret they've been carrying, like, oh my gosh, like you were able to get in. I've also kind of thought about that before. You know, I've also thought about, is there something different? And so people were like coming out of the woodwork and asking for help. And I was happy to do it, you know, because I was like, oh, cool. You know, other people want to do this. Here's how you do it. Now other friends and cousins and family members are getting into great schools, getting into medical school, et cetera. And then they started telling people, now it's the cousin's cousin, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
And over time, it just kind of grew organically out of my own necessity. And eventually—
So this started like right out of high school. You were looking to get into college and give yourself the best advantage. Mm-hmm. So what were the things that you discovered? Like, did you just start looking for books and you found somebody that wrote about this and knew it?
I can't even tell you like specific books that I read. I just
remember, right? It was a while back.
I mean, looking through these like school websites and reading their essays and then, you know, buying a book maybe on college essays and being like, oh my gosh, like the way I'm writing about and the way every kid in my school is writing. Oh, I'm Armenian. You know, my parents came here from another country. We experienced the Armenian genocide and this is what I want to do. The end. I was like, okay, these essays are sounding completely different. They're about personal things that you couldn't, you know, that only you would know, right? And like your parents might not even be able to tell the school this thing about you. So, you know, going deeper and deeper and getting more and more personal and sharing it with strangers, right? You're putting, at that time, we used to mail applications. So it's like, I'm putting something in the mail.
People know what paper is, who's listening?
Paper. And also like, who, what? There's someone in central New York who reads this paper and I just tell them everything about me. So it was a very strange experience. And
so you discovered that the more personal the essay, the better advantage it was giving you.
Yeah.
Right?
The thing that probably that makes you a little bit uncomfortable, something that I couldn't learn from your resume. So I started, you know, I grew up with Tourette syndrome, had it since about age 8. And so I started writing my essay about the treatment for it. And you know, being at the doctor's office and what that's like and what it's like to navigate life socially and how that has set me up to pursue the career, you know, that I want to pursue and the education I want to pursue. And that worked. And I used that model essentially to get amazing scholarships and fellowships and, you know, in the multiple six figures over the years and help other people. And so, yeah, along the way, people started asking for help. But then when it grew to a certain point, I found myself, and every entrepreneur, I think, goes through this. I was like saying similar things again and again and again. And I want to send someone a resource. Like I was, you know, I would say, Mitch, like read this online. I found there was nothing really good online.
Right.
There were a bunch of tips, 5 tips to write an essay. You know how those are, 5 tips to start a business.
It's like really help you.
Exactly. And they don't do anything for you. So I said, you know what? I think I could write something better, something I want my students to have. I put it in, you know, on the internet, on a blog, and I was like, read this. I wrote it so I don't have to write it again.
Now, this was after college,
years.
You graduated.
After years, yeah.
Oh, so years, this was even after UCLA?
This was good, yeah. So, you know, after college, you know, moved back to LA, did my PhD in psychology at UCLA. And so it was during that time I started writing. And then all of a sudden, you know, it was only before it was word of mouth through people who knew me.
Right.
And then I remember the first time.
Was it even a business at that point, or you really were just helping out people that knew you?
Still helping out. And so, and then, you know, someone random reached out to me. Yeah. The story of the business is I remember I emailed my parents one night saying, I have a business now. So if you know people who want help, let me.
Like, I'm doing it officially.
It's probably like a 4-sentence, like a 3-sentence email. I could probably dig it up somewhere. And so that happened. So that's the start of the business. No, but what really I think changed things for me was when random people I had no connection to reached out and said, hey, can you help with my application? I was like, who are you?
Right.
And
they read the blog article or something?
Yeah. But except I had no idea how Google, you know, I'm someone.
Yeah, well, in those days, blogging was kind of new, right? It wasn't, there wasn't so much noise. There wasn't so much competition. The algorithms weren't. Yeah. Okay.
And even I'm talking even 5 to 7 years, you know, like it's a completely different beast. Like,
yeah. It changes weekly. World. I know. It's crazy.
Yeah. And so when that happened, it's like, oh my gosh. Okay. And then I eventually started getting, so I started writing more. And I remember when my newsletter had like 8 people, I would tell my wife, I need to write this guide. And she's like, why? Why do you need to get it done tonight? I was like, people are waiting for me.
Right. 8 people are waiting for it.
But I had that mentality of like, I felt this responsibility to these people who, you know, are reading this newsletter. Right.
Well, it's probably good because there were probably more people out there reading it than you knew of. So,
yes,
you know, yeah,
exactly. And now there's more than 8 people on the newsletter and more, a few more eyeballs. But,
right.
So, I mean, that was the genesis. And then over time, basically got more sophisticated. Built systems, you know, I used to do it all myself. And then I remember I was giving a guest lecture at USC. And then there was a woman in the audience who came up to me after the talk and the presentation was on psychological assessment. It wasn't even about entrepreneurship. And she said, you know what, like my professor, you know, included your business in your introduction. You know, I kind of do this work too on the side. And so if you have more students than you can handle, like send them to me. I said, no, you should join our team.
Work for you, work with you. And, yeah.
And then I was like, you know, worried about that because I was like, you know.
Now, what was she saying she did on the side? Like essay writing or the whole
process?
She
would assist people with the admissions process. And so, okay. And then I was really nervous, you know, hiring the first person because it's like, you know, I know the way I do it and I can always ensure my own quality. Right. And then it's like, how is this going to work? And it worked beautifully. This person's a gem. And so, you know,
well, you think that's attributable to you and the systems you built or the fact that she's a bright both. Person just kind of fit with a little bit of both.
Okay. Both. You know, who knows if my first experience was bad, who knows what the
right.
What
you would never gotten another employee. That's
I would have been like, you can never trust anyone. No, yeah.
But you knows? Never build a business around that. You
who
can't.
Knows, right?
You need good people. Right.
Yeah. So I feel very fortunate. I'm certainly not. I never take 100% of credit for anything. I don't even know if I take 50% of credit for it. So yeah, I feel very fortunate.
I'm much more
to work
comfortable with that too. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel fortunate working with great people, supporting great students and families and all that kind of stuff. It's a blessing. So, I mean, that was the thing. And then, you know, one became three, you know, three became more. And,
right.
And then we systematize things more and more, produce more and more content to now where, you know, our site gets a lot of reach.
Yeah. So you say you have a pretty big team now. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's just, you know, it just grew organically. Again, I joke sometimes that I don't talk to any 8-year-olds. And when I ask them, what do you want to be when you grow up? No one says, I want to help people get into college. No right. one. And I don't no anticipate one. Anyone ever will.
Right.
No, you know, I think they'd rather be LeBron James than do my job. And so it's not something that I think people just naturally gravitate towards. I think it's one of these things where you demonstrate interest in it. You see that you have strong skill. You're good at it. You assist people. They have tremendous success. And look, if we weren't doing a good job, I would have never done it.
Right,
and
obviously.
So that's why I kept going. And now I do this full time and really enjoy it. That's the story. That's the long answer.
So now did you come to, I always ask this question. Did you come to a point where you say, okay, I have a business here. Did you sit down and kind of sketch out, write a plan for what you thought it looked like?
No.
You didn't. You didn't
I say, still okay, don't have a business plan.
All right. Well, that's not good advice for people listening. So they should have a business plan. Maybe Chirag doesn't need one, but that does not mean that people listening shouldn't have one. But do you don't think that looking back that there was a point where you sketched out or thought in your mind, like, this is what I see. I would like to know you. So you don't have a vision for the company. Beyond just
I wouldn't
helping
say
people.
That. I okay. wouldn't say that. What I'm saying is I do not have a formal written business plan. I never right. had one. Now, along the way, you know, you yeah. put yourself in positions where new opportunities open up to you. And when you have those opportunities, you take them. And as things have developed, I now have an ultra clear vision of what we're doing now and what we're going to do tomorrow. But to, right. but you know, I never had the formal written
no,
down
I realize
business
that.
Plan.
And a lot
no
of people
such document
don't.
Exists.
Right. And a lot of people don't, but you're doing at least in your mind, like strategic planning as opportunities come. Right. Okay.
Significantly. Right, okay. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Because I was talking to a friend of mine this morning, Jeff, who was on my podcast and he's a entrepreneur's coach or whatever. And, you know, a lot of people don't have or take the time to have that vision and say, okay, well, if I want this to be a business, it can't just be me. People think like when it's just them, they have a business. They really don't. They're their own employees. What it comes down to, you wanted to build a you know, a company that provided additional more services and better service, but you wanted the people to have your own vision, right?
Yeah, but that's the but what I'm trying to say here, and I'm going to push back a little bit, is, you know, I agree with you that if it's just you, you're a solo practitioner, it's not a business, right? At the same time, I think that too many, so I didn't have the vision at the start. I never did it. I never started helping a single person thinking one day this will become X. Like that happened organically because we did good work. Now that it, when I saw the opportunity and became a business, now it's a different story. I just want to warn people out there to not try to get everything perfect before they do something. And the reason why I want to stress the, like, I never had a formal business plan. I hear so much about like, ooh, I just need to get my business plan.
Yeah, no,
and
that's a
I
bad,
need to get my cards and my website has to look a certain way before I launch. I'm like, my website at the beginning looks like it was made by a second grader.
Right.
And you know what I mean? So I wanna warn people, like if you're like the, oh no, I will only, you know, do this when X, Y, and Z happens.
Yeah, they're always gonna have something that's not done.
And chances are what you start with isn't what it's going to look like.
Right, it's
after.
An evolution.
So why are you spending your time trying?
It's
just
develop.
Anxiety. It's procrastination.
Right. Exactly.
And so that's why I want to, you know, tell people, no, I'm not saying I'm just like a rudderless ship with no vision and
no,
you know, whatever
happens. Definitely not.
You know, I just want to, you know, encourage people to get going and realize that, you know, those pivots are part of the process. That's like, you know, no one gets married thinking they know every single thing that's going to happen
close,
in their marriage.
Right?
Not just, even close. Right. And if you think so, you're wrong, you know?
Yeah, of course. And you know what, Chirag? I think it's really important. And I say this all the time, and I think that's excellent advice. You can't wait till all the lights are green to head towards town. It's not going to happen. It's not going to work. You're going to be, this has got to be done. And then something else is going to change. And you'll have another reason that you can't do. And you're right. Analysis of paralysis and analysis. People just get paralyzed by their own, you know, inability to just move forward. And you're right. It always will change. You always modify your brand. You always change your message.
Sure.
You learn things along the way that you weren't happy with how it worked before. Or maybe it did work before. And now people have caught on and it's working different going forward. And I'm sure your business always evolves just like everyone, you know, the law doesn't stay the same. So I'm sure the college admissions process doesn't stay the same, but excellent, excellent advice.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody gets the impression that you're just winging it and have no plan.
Oh no.
You're just developing it as you go.
And look, I don't, and you know, when I brought up my response, it was not at all to say, no, I promise whatever, like I'm doing my work. And that's going to survive this podcast. But, what I'm saying is I want people like to have the right takeaway here about, you know, not to be so obsessed about having this, that, and I love your metaphor about, you know, the lights being waiting for the lights to all be green. A, they're not all going to be green.
It's not impossible.
If you think they are all green, you're wrong. They're not all green. So you just gotta begin somewhere.
Yeah. And I also want to make a comment too. There are people who are solopreneurs maybe, right? And they don't want to build a company and they want to stay.
Okay.
And that's fine. Yeah. Exactly. I'm making the point that they all have to follow your path and then developing into a business. No, not at all. I'm a solopreneur right now. I used to have a bigger law firm. Where I'm going to go from here, frankly, I don't really know. But
we don't know.
You know, I don't want to be practicing when I'm 85 or 90 years old. I have some colleagues who do that, and they're a little tough. They have a little tough time with technology. But all right. So let's get back into it. So now your company has, you know, developed where you're really providing service across the board, and it seems that a lot of it is not self-taught, like self-discovery, right? I mean, you're doing the research, you're discovering like what are people doing to make themselves more interesting, to stand out to admissions counselors, right? And you started originally just with college, because you do a lot of graduate school work now, right?
You know, yeah. I mean, initially, because when I was in college, I was doing it, so I was helping people, you know, in the sphere that I knew. At the same time, I was pre-med all through college. I actually did very well at Cornell and was pre-med the whole time, even up to the point I graduated. I decided to pivot to psychology afterwards. But so along the way, you know, the admissions nerd in me, I was reading everything about med school admissions and consuming that. And so I actually helped other people get into medical school while I was still in college. And so the interest in medical school was, again, it was personal. You know, right. I wanted to learn it for me and helped other people with it. And so, you know, sometimes people ask about, you know, medical school admissions and they're like, you're a psychologist. I'm like, yeah, but you're not asking me to do surgery. You're asking me to help you get into medical school. It has nothing to do with the practice of medicine. And I happen to be very good at it. Right. So in other words, like, it's about telling your story in a compelling way about, right. you know, things that I couldn't learn from your resume, and also helping people develop the right extracurricular profile, secure the right recommendation letters. We now prep people for the MCAT. And so it's evolved and changed over time because we saw that there was a need to support
prep, you
our
mean
students
like tutor
better.
Them for the test. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Okay. And
you expanded
because,
into that.
Yeah. And because we found, you know, that a lot of the, you know, courses out there from the big box companies, so to speak,
right.
They're all very, they're all very cookie cutter. You know, you take this course, you do these practice exams
and review. Yeah. They're
one size fits all the same. And so we're like, well, this is not good enough. Their diagnostics aren't specific enough. They don't evaluate strategy weaknesses the way that we can. And so I always tell people we do things in a very cumbersome way. In other words, like developing these resources the right way, doing things truly white glove takes a lot of time.
I'm sure
because
it does,
you develop a system and applying it to certain people and, you know, digging into their quest, you know, their question logs and seeing what they did wrong, identifying patterns. These are not easy things. They're very time consuming things to do. But so I always thought, you know, rather than develop the one size fits all, I'd rather get into the trenches with kids and students and help them that way.
So you have a team of people that do tutoring and you have mm-hmm. a team of people that do the admissions process. Mm-hmm. It's a different skill, obviously.
Correct. Yeah. They're different. You don't just say, oh, you do this. You could teach the test. No. They're right. Very different skill sets and backgrounds.
All right. So it seems evident to me that if you're coming in as an undergrad, right, that you want to stand out and seem different. I'm not sure it's evident as to how you do that. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And I've heard this at the graduate school level, especially in medical school, right? You think, well, if you do your prereqs and you do well in biology and chemistry mm-hmm. and organic and all that type of stuff, you apply to medical school, they'll let you in. But I've heard, and you're going to confirm, I'm sure, that they're looking for more well-rounded students. And very often they even want a student that didn't even major in some science. Maybe they're like, my daughter's kind of a journalism, creative writing expert major. And she's going to do her prereqs for medical school.
Yep.
Because it seems that the school's right. They're looking for more diverse. They don't want everybody to be a biology major coming into medical school.
Right.
Is that true?
Here's a word from our sponsors. Uplift your marketing and reinforce your brand with a digital business card from Digital Accelerant. Use a text marketing combination to stand out in front of your competition. Digital business cards make you memorable and most of all help you bring in new business through its warm lead generator. Motion graphics, intro, outro, and inspirational videos can be added during setup. Text the word LAW to 21000, that's L-A-W to 21000, to learn how to get your own digital business card. Suffering from slow internet speed? Worried about hackers? Fetch Pro gets the internet from your smartphone to your Windows and Mac computer without paying for a hotspot. Always get the fastest, most stable, and secure internet access on your computer with Fetch Pro. Follow their affiliate link on our website to learn more and get connected with Fetch. Printify is the online service that simplifies and automates the process of sourcing and creating print-on-demand products branded with your company logo, product, or service. Printify is a better alternative to pre-purchasing and warehousing your merchandise for distribution or sale. Follow their link from our website to learn how to set up your own online store. And be sure to visit our online store and get yourself some podcast merch. Follow the link in the show notes to learn more about all of our sponsors. And now back to our show.
So there's the question of what they're looking for, but also who comes to the table and in hindsight, how we interpret that data, right? So The most popular set of majors for medical school admissions far and away is the life sciences. Yeah. In other words, people who do biology, molecular biology, neuroscience,
right. Chemistry, physics, whatever, right?
Well, those would be physical sciences. Those would be a separate category.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Got it.
So there's that, and then there's life sciences, there's mathematics, there's social sciences, humanities, and then other stuff. And so, there are going to be slight differences in terms of the rates of acceptance for different majors. But it's hard to say whether that's because schools are looking for people in those different majors, or because, you know, life sciences are crowded and you have the high achievers and really low achievers, because people in life sciences tend to want to go into medicine, all this kind of stuff. But it is true that medical schools do want, you know, a diverse student body. And so part of that diversity comes from people who have pursued different disciplines, their service experiences and extracurriculars are different. And so sometimes students make the big error of trying to be too well-rounded in and of themselves. In other words, you shouldn't try to be everything to everyone. You have to obviously meet your foundational requirements, but beyond that, I want you to be a specialist. So let's say your daughter is doing her prereqs, she's doing great in them, she gets her patient exposure and her research experiences, but then she realizes that what she really loves and what wants her shtick to be is medical journalism. And so maybe she starts to document, you know, healthcare in different countries, or she takes healthcare findings from the New England Journal of Medicine and publishes them for a lay audience and gets an internship at a place like the New York Times. And all of a sudden she's, you know, translating things for the lay public. And now she's doing a lot of medical dissemination, you know, medical research dissemination, using that for marketing communications, assisting the CDC, you know, like we can go all over the place. And so that person, even though their shtick, like I said, or their spike specialty, whatever you want to call it, is related to journalism, it's still a critical part of healthcare. How much have we seen during the pandemic where there is knowledge, but because it's so poorly disseminated or the communication is too complex or not right, it just leads people to make poor decisions.
Yeah, well, that's a huge problem in healthcare, obviously.
Correct. Right? So you could find the best drug in the world, but if you can't, you know, influence people to take it, your drug is
right.
If a pill. People think it's that just there's a pill on the counter,
some little secret thing in the thing that goes in your body and they could track you and read your thoughts, you got a little bit of a problem.
Yeah. So that's the thing, you know, so that's just an example I just thought of off the cuff when you said your daughter does journalism. So it's not the major specifically, it's what someone does through their interests, which obviously tend to be associated with their major.
Well, that makes sense, because I do understand that if you're interested in studying something at school, they're going to look to see if you're just putting that on your application and you're a member of every club in the high school, which, by the way, the schools are
not
stupid.
Yeah,
because they know you can't go to every meeting, so you obviously just signed up for everything. And to be more of a specialist, if you're interested in, you know, my daughter was big in dance and she went to a dance studio. She's dancing 15 hours a week. And, you know, that obviously limited her other extracurricular at school. So the only other thing she did we lose you?
I'm here.
Oh, okay. The only other thing she did was she joined the school. It was either paper or magazine and became one of the editors and wrote for that. And it wasn't healthcare related, but it was writing. So it supported what she was doing. And she didn't sign up for every other, she couldn't do it. She wasn't, you know, available. So, and I think she wrote her essay about dance and she probably will do some tap dancing maybe at school if there's a troupe or something. That's just not her major. It's not going to be her living, but she has always been interested in medicine. She made us one year for Hanukkah buy her Grey's Anatomy. I don't mean like the video series.
The book.
The book. And she had all kinds of tags and marks and, you know, dog-eared pages and notes. I mean, all over the thing. And then she made me get her something for the Mac. It was like for her MacBook, it was this program where you could like pull up a 3D picture of an organ and open it and label it. And this is years. She was like 11 and she's stuck with it. So we'll see. I told you she just got there yesterday. Today's her first day being a student. Classes don't start till next week. We'll see what happens. My son was interested in medicine for 2 weeks when he got to school, and now he's a computer science major. So,
changes mine.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me about the are there other things that I should know? I mean, is it really just about differentiating yourself from an essay standpoint and other things, or is there things that people should know, kids, adults, when it comes to the admissions process? Are there tricks, or are there not really tricks?
I often say the admissions process is not complex, it's hard. In other words, let me give you an example, you know, going back to my LeBron James reference from earlier. You know, if you ask me, Dr. Shamassian, how do you dunk a basketball? Well, you know, the rim is 10 feet above the ground. And, right. You know, how tall are you? Okay. And how much is your wingspan? Okay. Well, you need to be able, and the ball is this high. So based on that, you need to, you know, take a few steps and jump 4 feet off the ground and then you just dunk it in.
Yeah.
But obviously the jumping 4 feet
is a lot.
And so it's hard, even though to explain it, to understand it, it's not complex. And so medical school admissions, college admissions are also that way. And so the way they are is that, you know, you obviously have to get great stats. When I say stats, I mean numbers, GPA, test scores. Although in college admissions, we're living during an interesting time when, you know, most schools are gone optional. Some schools have gone test blind, and that's a whole evolving thing. But still, numbers matter. You have to be, you know, at or near the top of your class, you know, do well with your standardized tests, AP exams, IB exams, that sort of thing. But
my daughter's experience during the pandemic was that if you didn't submit a score and you went optional, they just deferred you till the spring and said, we'll deal with it then. Most of the schools, they didn't even. So if you wanted to get in earlier, didn't help you.
Yeah, they were figuring it out last year. You know, I think this year schools will have a little bit more. I mean, they'll have a lot more experience on how to deal with these things. But
you think they're going to stick with that?
Schools are going to stick with test optional. I mean, it's not just pandemic related reasons where, you couldn't get a test date and stuff like that.
Right.
The other big issue is the social justice climate we're living in our country.
Yeah,
so what ended up happening is Mitch, you know, every single school basically, you know, who went test optional, and this is certainly true of elite schools, they recruited the most diverse incoming class in their history.
Because people applied when they
Complex
right?
question. Because the schools are also existing in the social climate. So they might also say, you know what, we do need to change the way we review students holistically. But also we know in our country that test scores are highly associated with income, and income in our country is highly associated with race. And so when you make tests optional, you're going to get more applications from students from low income and minority backgrounds. And then also if you're using that less in your assessment, you're going to recruit more. So imagine how popular Princeton would be, Mitch, if they said, we recruited the most diverse class when we went test optional, we are going back to requiring tests. They would be so unpopular if they did that. So I think politically, it also wouldn't play well.
That makes sense.
And so I see, you know, people ask me, how do I see it? I don't know if we're going to go back to a world where the SAT or the ACT remain required. I just don't see it. So we're having this conversation at a really interesting time, but still, stats are critical. If you don't have them, you're probably not going to be super seriously considered. Now, stats alone do not get you in. I know plenty of people
would get you to the next week pile, right?
You got to be considered, right?
Exactly.
Right.
And I have a friend does work for Harvard or something, and she told me that if, at least before the pandemic, let's say, if you didn't have a perfect test score, you got on the discard pile. Like they first start with, okay, if you have a perfect test score, maybe close to a perfect test score, we'll put you in the pile and then we'll could do the next step. I don't know if that's true or not. But that's,
I mean, they get so many applications. That's the thing. They have to figure out their own filtration systems. But then also Harvard can fill their incoming class from the rejected pile and have nearly as good of a class. That's how strong their applications are. And so, you know, they're looking for the best of the best. It's a seller's market, right? Like they have all the power in this process.
Yep, no question.
They have way more applications than seats. And so they get to call the shots. Now, once you have stats, you got your foot in the door. But what really differentiates you is what you've pursued outside the classroom, as well as the strengths of your essays and your extracurriculars. So the recommendation letters. The extracurriculars are the hardest part for people to figure out. Because when it comes to tests, Mitch, study
subjective,
this, get this number, I know where I stand. So people like to, in such an unknown gray process, people love being able to grab onto something. They love being able to say, I have a 1580. That means I'm at this level.
Right.
Okay, I can breathe. Now, right. If I tell you, give me your resume and I said to you, grade your resume for me. What do you think your resume is out of 100? They'll say, no one has an idea.
Right.
And so that's why people are less confused. So they gravitate toward the thing they know, which is school right. and tests and numbers. And they completely neglect oftentimes or largely neglect what actually separates them, which is the strength of their extracurricular profile. And the students who become specialists and, you know, have very nerdy, intense pursuits of one or two things.
Right.
Those are the students.
For something they
correct.
Do.
And frankly, yeah. I would argue it makes them more interesting.
I would agree 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. You wouldn't want to come to me, you know, if you asked me, hey, what do you do for work? If I said, well, I help people get into medical school. I bake sourdough bread. I make shoes, you know, I make shoes from scratch and I arrange flowers.
Yeah. And you're like, who is this guy?
You're going to be like, who's this rando? Like, right. I want the guy who does this, who lives, eats and breathes this thing. Right. So that's the thing where as a college, you know, college, hopefully you have to think about medical school, hopefully same thing. And one of the rebuttals I often get from parents is like, what are they expecting of our kids? These right. are kids at 14. They just have to know everything. Not what I'm saying.
That's not the case. Right.
You have to they have to go for things that they like and do it passionately. And also going into a top school is a privilege.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not like I think a lot of people expect that or think that they deserve a certain school, but no, like a couple thousand people are getting into Harvard every year. It's not like, you know, these are very special people. And so if you don't want to pursue things that way, that's okay. But your expectations have to align with that.
Right. But isn't the process the same? If I want to go to, and I'm in New Jersey, right? So if I want to go to UCLA or USC, or I'm going to go to North Carolina, or I want to go to one of these state schools where they take a huge number of kids in state and it's very hard to get into, the process is going to be the same, right? I need to stand out. Do they say, wow, not only is this kid smart and have good grades and everything mm-hmm. like that, but he's an interesting person.
Correct.
An interesting student. And interesting doesn't mean you do 14 things and they're all different. I think parents are very frustrated though with the process because they go to, and I've been through this, this is my second kid, right? I go to these meetings with, say, local alumni or sometimes even on campus, right? And you meet with admissions people and you ask them pointed questions. Like I used to ask the question all the time, would you rather have a student get straight A's in standard courses or get B's in advanced AP honors courses, you know, because they're challenging themselves. Their answer was always, well, we would prefer the student who gets A's in the honors courses. And I would say, that's not the question.
Exactly.
That I ask you. And I think parents are very frustrated because they don't know, because obviously the process is hard, right? Because there's a human component. There's a human being behind the application looking at the profile. And they have biases and they have a system that they need to but it's somewhat subjective, obviously. And you have a child who's on the other side. It's not objective like the scores.
Yep, you're right. And then the answer to that question, I agree with the horrible answer of, well, take the hard course and get the A.
Of course, they want.
But I'll follow up with what I see as the real answers to that question.
Yeah.
Because people ask me this all the time.
The question was obviously, should your child challenge themselves or not? Not what do you want in a student, right?
Yeah. So the B in the AP course is desirable over the A in all the regular classes from what I have observed. Now the second part to that answer, though, unfortunately, Mitch, is they don't even know what the answer to that question is.
Right, that's why they're answering it that way. Yeah.
Because the context is important, right? Like if someone takes those, you know, B's in ultra challenging courses, the school is crazy tough, but they were also a kid that bussed to that school from an hour away because they lived in a certain part of the city and they're the first kid from their school to even apply to college. It, you know what I mean?
So
it just changes. So the reason why they give you a cop-out answer, and we're looking, and why do parents even ask the question? We're searching for certainty.
We're nervous,
during a very uncertain process.
Right.
And so the college admissions professional is taking their scapegoat answer and dodging the question because it's so complicated. But if you're forcing me, you said you got to bet one way or another, I'd say take the B.
Yeah.
Take the
look, B. I, the look, course. I understand that if all your if your kid takes all honors and AP courses, right, gets all Bs, no As, and the and there's no other challenging factors, the school might say, well, you know what, he might have trouble here. This might be hard for him to come.
And that would be fair.
Yeah,
that would be fair because these are hard schools. That would be fair for them to say that.
I'll be the first person to tell you, I struggled at Cornell. I got into Cornell because I had a lot of academics and I had a lot of leadership and stuff through Jewish youth and stuff. And I also found a division of Cornell that had more average scores that more fit my profile. I didn't apply to the main school and I got in. I still have a Cornell degree. But looking back, it was like you took me down an alley, doused me with gasoline, lit me on fire for 4 years. It was more than I'd ever experienced in my high school. I came from basically a blue collar town. And never had, I think we had two AP courses in my whole high school. So I didn't have any of them. I had one honors course. And it was very, very, very hard. And I don't know if it served me. I love Cornell, but I don't know if it served me well because I have nothing to compare it to.
Yeah.
If I went to a large state institution and studied something that I really loved and did well, better. I don't know. I came out. I'm trying to think. I probably came out with like low Bs. I like supported the upper part of the class by, you know, but the way they say that. But it was hard. It was very hard. If I knew it was going to be that hard, probably wouldn't have gone to Cornell because I wasn't that kind of student.
Yeah. So, but there was something about you, right? Because the school, and we love to try and distill admissions and even college performance to academics and numbers and stuff like that. There was something about you that made you interesting to the admissions committee at the time. And I'm sure that you have great relationships and people benefited from knowing you and from you being there and stuff like that. So when you think about the entire picture, you know, there are reasons why you ended up the way you are.
I'm pretty good when it comes to networking and stuff. I went to the summer program at Cornell. I made contacts there. I found whoever was the best tutor for SATs and was a Cornell alum and on their alumni committee. So I sought her out. She was very busy, but my mom said, my son wants to go to Cornell. She goes, I'll make time for you on Monday afternoon. And she opened up her schedule. So I played the game. I went to every Cornell event and I would meet people. And I wanted to show my interest in the school. Did that help me or not? I have no idea to this day, but I got to believe it helped me.
Demonstrated interest at the time was a bigger deal than it is today. And you did good.
Yeah. So it worked for me. But I do feel now as a parent, the frustration of the enormity of the process, the availability of the ease of application now, right? So the application pool goes up just because you and I didn't have to lay out 17 applications on a dining room table and do all these hand write the essays and
print them.
We had to put packages together and mail them out. I don't know when you went, but
if you had a typo, you change it, you print it again.
Yeah, exactly. There was no, what do they call it? The common application, right?
Nope.
There was none of that stuff. And then
I don't remember. Maybe there was when I don't even remember, honestly.
Yeah. So my point is that you really had to want to go to these schools. I think I applied to 8 or 10. I had a friend applied to 19 schools. I'm like, forget, I would never
have done that. That's normal
now. Yeah, because it's a much easier, right?
It's also easier to apply. It's also harder to get it. Yeah, exactly.
Their pools are bigger. So this is a very depressing conversation for most of the parents.
Yeah, well, happy Friday, Mitch.
Oh, boy. But you know what? My son applied to several schools. He got into, and he's very happy at Indiana. My daughter applied to a lot of schools, and it was a very tough time, like you said. Mm-hmm. I think her ACTs got put off 4 or 5 times. She didn't like her score. Finally, she went test optional. Brutal. I'm sure it knocked her off for a lot of schools, but she got into Maryland. She's very happy there. And it does work out, but I mean, parents lose sleep a lot of sleep over this stuff. Yeah. So how do some, like, what do they do with regard to like getting help? They go to your website, read some eBooks, start interacting with your company. Is that where you
essentially
start?
Essentially, I mean, you know, for folks who, you know,
like
people,
at birth or man, like when's the best time to start with your company? They don't call you in their third semester of their junior
that's
year.
That's right. When your child is born, buy them a onesie of your favorite university and then put their name in our newsletter. No, yeah. I'm teasing.
And Instagram, show the school your interest.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I would say that there are obviously exceptions. I've had someone reach out to me in first grade and stuff, but you know, people, the earliest they'll reach out is around eighth grade, seventh grade. Right. But usually during high school, and obviously people who are applying to medical school anytime from the start of college. And we help people longitudinally. I love helping students for 4 years and developing their profile. Because if someone comes to you senior year, you can only work with what they did. Sometimes they did a good job. Most of the time they didn't. And that's not their fault. They just didn't know. And so, you know, I always tell people it depends, you know, they're like, well, is it too early? I say, how confident do you feel about doing it alone? They're like, not confident. I'm like, well, then we should talk.
Not too early.
But if you feel good about doing it solo, okay, I hope that's true. But yeah, I mean, you can go for that and then get SA help later and all that kind of stuff. But the takeaway is that people can get value at any stage. And Mitch, you know, we were talking about earlier how my parents immigrated to this country with probably literally a few hundred dollars to their name.
Right.
You know, I feel like everyone says that, but I'm pretty
literally.
Sure that's my parents.
Yeah.
And so I know that I didn't have these resources, nor could my parents afford, you know, this kind of support. So from the beginning, I said, look, I want to put this all out. More people read our stuff far and away than I ever get to interact with.
And of course,
every year people reach out and they say, you've never met me, but all I did was use your resources and I got into Princeton.
Thank you.
Right. And so, you know, I tell people,
that's what you want to hear, right?
And I don't care, you know, if someone, you know, doesn't interact with me, so long as they get the value, whether it's from one-on-one services, just from our website content, or, you know, signing on our newsletter, it's a treat really to touch people that way.
Okay. So from a business model standpoint, how do you normally work with a student? Is it a package price? Does it depend on what services you're providing?
Yeah. So what happens typically is someone will find our resources either through a referral or internet search. They'll visit our site, you know, have their name in a newsletter and, you know, receive resources. Eventually, when it's their time to apply or when they want services, they'll say, hey, I've been following for a while. I'd love to talk to you. We have a conversation. And yeah, there are certain plans that I created essentially based on what I know students need. Sometimes people say, well, I don't know if I need this. I'm like, you don't know it, but you also need the other thing.
Right.
And so people sign up for a plan and then that covers everything. So I never thought, sometimes I've seen organizations do this thing where it's like, yeah, we'll help you with this many essays. The word limit is this, we'll do this many edits. I'm like, no, I don't care. I'd rather charge a bit more, but have it be fully unlimited because after round two of those edits, your essay might not be done and you need more. And so I'd rather give you the right service rather than lower the price to give you.
And then you're deciding, should I pay more? Should I get this done?
Yeah. What, you know, should I have another session? You have to take that. You know, I think it's important for families to just be fully supported rather than try and figure out in a field they don't know.
Yeah. Like,
should I take another pill? I don't know.
Right.
Go to an expert. Yeah. I ask them, you know.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I do appreciate you spending some time with me. We will put links to your website. And I think there's videos on there too. And there's certainly eBooks, right, on the website.
Yep. There are some great resources as in the way of, you know, college admissions eBook, med school admissions eBook. I'll also send you some resources. There are a few things we talked about extracurriculars, majors. That I
we'll
think
put links to
I've written about all this
I like
stuff
freebies
before, so.
for listeners. It's a good way to start.
It's all
right. So what you do, you start helping them, like say at the beginning of high school, going up to college, they usually call me in a panic, realizing their kid's turning 18 just before they're leaving for college. And I have to get them like a living will, HIPAA release, all these forms, because you don't want to discover your kid's in the health center when he's at college and you can't get any information because he's now an adult.
Yep.
So I have an ebook on that too. It's called Parent Survival Guide, Sending Your Kids to College. But mine's at the end. You can wait till don't wait till 2 weeks before you go, but you can wait till a month or two before you go. So.
That's awesome.
All right, Chirag, I appreciate it. I'm going to go take a nap now, I think. And let's definitely stay in touch. I got a girl who, let's see if she sticks with the medical thing. And if she does,
happy to help her.
Definitely put you in touch.
In the meantime, pleasant dreams.
All right. Thanks, Chirag. Have a good weekend.
See you.
If you like the podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Amazon Music, and many of the other podcast directories. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at info@mindhackerlaw.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur is hosted and produced by me, Mitch Beinhacker. If you'd like more information about my legal services, you can find me on social media or visit my website at beinhackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.